And wasn't it that the Bush camp constantly maintained that they had no connection, knowledge, or anything to do with the Swift Vote for Truth people? Well, maybe they didn't at the time, but they seem to now. Does anybody remember Jim Wright, Speaker of the House from Texas back in, I guess, the 80s, during the Reagan years? He met with the government of Nicaragua on some occasions, supposedly on the basis of trying to negotiate trade arrangements. But people acted towards that situation like Pelosi's, saying that how dare him try to conduct a foreign policy with the Nicaraguan Somoza people, or Sandinistas, I mean, when Reagan is the president. So, do you feel that there's a fundamental wrong image to congressional people being involved in meeting with foreign diplomats? And Yep. I think that's true. It's very much in keeping with that. Well, the liberals and conservatives both, people in general, are real bad about what I'm going to do, and that is, and I'm one of them. That is that when it suits your purpose, you talk original intent of the founding framers, and then when you don't, you talk about you have to live in the modern age. Well, most of the time, the original intent tries to limit liberal social programs that liberals complain about. But here's one of the liberal things that you can say goes back to original intent. There was a fear that presidents would act like kings and monarchs in the conduct of foreign policy. So they built into the document checks and balances over foreign policy actions that Congress had, and the War Declaration one is the most significant one. So to make the claim that the executive branch has exclusive authority in the area of foreign policy, I don't think that's in keeping with the intent of the framers had in mind. And the closest I know that the courts ever addressed this, because they're kind of like a third corner of this argument, is in the 1936 Curtis versus Wright case, in which they did say the president does have exclusive authority. But what does the court know when they rule wrong like that? Well, we don't have to listen to that. We can interpret it the way that the framers intended. Anyway, enough bellowing about that. Back to World War I. So we left off at number 8. And as I said, that I would bet that most Americans were shocked and disgusted with the way the war bubbled up so quickly in Europe and seemed to be fought for all the wrong reasons, not for human rights, not for justice, not even for self-defense. I guess maybe Serbians were fighting for self-defense, but they were complicit in the assassination too. So most Americans were just glad that there are two oceans to keep us away from the wrangling eastern hemisphere of the world. And Wilson verifies that with his famous phrase, to remain neutral in both in both name and spirit. But as I suggested right before we left, that there was some draw to both sides, which will grow in time, mostly to the Allied side of the conflict, but we'll start with the first one. Who do you think would be most likely to be in favor of central power victory?
Immigrants
from?
Germany.
Yeah, the nations involved, such as Germany or Austria, and to a smaller degree Turkey, but especially Austrian and German mid-continent people would be much in favor of their own families, their own cousins, their own homeland maybe, being victorious in this conflict, as long as it remained something the U.S. is not involved in. Now, obviously, once the U.S. enters the conflict, that can't be their expressions and feelings, but as long as it's just kind of a neither has a dog in the fight, you can take sides without having your patriotism questioned. So German Americans were sympathetic to Germany winning this conflict. And one of the things about German Americans that, unlike most immigrant groups, they moved farther west into the Midwestern farm areas, Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in fact, as far west as California, Oregon. Most of your Midwest and far western states became the area where German Americans and Austrian Americans took their money and bought lands and became big farmers. And so it's not surprising that the senators and congresspersons who would come from those states, knowing that they have a disproportionate amount of German immigrant voters once they're naturalized citizens, are not going to be in any hurry to do anything against Germany. So that's one of the explanations for Midwestern and far western isolationism and anti-war feeling, is the large number of German American voters living in those areas. There'll be other reasons we'll come back to and look at it as to why the Midwest was so lackluster about the war. Irish Americans also favored a central powered victory, and the Irish were not in this war either way. So why would they care? Yes, because they hate England, because England had colonized Ireland, and anything, it's that classic phrase of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and in this case, if Germany can weaken England, it can only mean possible freedom for Ireland. In fact, during the conflict in 1916, on the Easter days, there was an uprising in Dublin known as the Easter Rising or Easter Rebellion, which the poorly planned and not really well staffed, but it was the hopes were that Britain would be so preoccupied with fighting the war, they couldn't subdue this rebellion. And if anybody saw the movie Michael Collins that Liam Neeson starred in back around 1999, I think, it starts off with exactly that scene going on there. There's fighting in front of a post office in Dublin. That is the Easter Rebellion taking place in 1916. It was crushed, and crushed cruelly, so much so that the majority of Irish people who didn't have a feeling about this uprising became even further anti-British. So the treatment by the British did result in, by 1920, another rebellion, and that resulted in a semi-autonomous Ireland called the Free State. So Irish Americans, no doubt, who had for quite some time raised money to feed the IRA, hoped to see the English lose this conflict or be harmed by the conflict so that the Irish can be free.
Is that the result of
Northern Ireland? That's kind of explained how that turns out. To follow up what I was saying, in 1919 and 1920, when at the end of World War I, another rebellion occurs, the English negotiate with the revolutionary forces and come up with an agreement in which all but the top 11, 14, 9, I used to know this, counties of Ulster area would become this autonomous free state. It's not an independent nation, but they have local legislature and they have an English governor over them. It's in many ways like kind of like a Commonwealth colony. And the North Ireland part would remain firmly part of Britain, which it is still today, although it's moving to have some of its own rule. And the southern portion, the majority of the island, became a full-fledged independent nation in 1948, following World War II. So outside of that, most of the feeling that was drawn one way or the other in this war is drawn to the pro-Allied side of the conflict, as number 10 shows the reasons given. And probably the first most obvious one is this common culture between Anglo-Saxon England and the United States. I used to bring lists of authors I forgot to bring with me, but I'd like if I was to throw out some names and say, are these authors English or American? Example would be Dickens, Charles Dickens, English. How about Henry Wadsworth Longfellow? He's American. Wordsworth? He's English. But that's what I was hoping would happen, because why do they seem to be a little bit hard to distinguish between?
Is there a lineage?
Yeah. Because the literature is quite similar, built around similar themes, built around similar culture. That's how much affinity there was for English culture. And if the names weren't so obvious, it'd be true for French culture, too, because there's a lot of that in the 19th century America. So it's kind of a strange love-hate relationship that exists, because there's the revolution back in the 1770s, then there's the War of 1812, but from the War of 1812 up to World War I, there are no further conflicts. In fact, there is this long period of England trying its best to buddy up to America and succeeding. And in many ways, Americans, they enjoy twisting the lion's tail and making fun of the British, but at the same time, in fashion and in technology, and in education and in music and other circles, they're aping the British, falling over backwards to build their homes like Victorian homes, etc. So there's probably a like cousins across the pond connection type feeling that never goes away, even from the days of the Independence War. And for sure there is similar political systems. Britain was a constitutional monarchy. Its monarch truly didn't exercise power, rather the parliament and prime ministers did. Democratically elected, a little bit different than ours, but nonetheless democratically elected. France had a democracy and no king anymore, an elected president. So if you looked at the differences in the two sides, the English and the French are in some form or fashion democracies quite close to our own. And what was Germany ruled by?
Kaiser.
A Kaiser, which was in essence like an emperor, or like a modern-day Caesar. At least they wanted to fashion themselves to mean that. How was Austria ruled?
An emperor.
An emperor. And Turkey?
An emperor.
Pretty much the Sultanate or Caliphate or whatever term they use at given time for the Ottoman Empire. And so there's no democratic check and balance in any of those three nations, so that autocrats run those nations, democrats ran the others. Now you might say, well, what about Russia? Weren't they, under the Tsar, more autocratic than all the Central Powers? Well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and so twice in two world wars we can overlook Tsars and Stalins if it's necessary to fight Germans. But Americans are thinking more in terms of Western culture, Western civilization, that there is this feeling that if Germans win, the barbaric Huns, the Vandals, they're going to take over Western civilization, where if the British and the French win, then society is safe and secure. Historians like to bandy about a lot about what would have happened had we stayed out of this conflict totally and Germany had won. Well, you know, what if history is always so hokey, but what if? Well, what if we had not decided to sail in those waters, or Germany had not decided to attack ships so thoroughly at the end, and we'd never gotten into conflict? It's feasible to assume, with Russia removing itself, that Germany would have won the conflict. How would the world have been different with a German victory in World War I?
They would have had the Euro.
Mm-hmm. Would we have been threatened? Would we have been attacked, you think? Pardon?
Eventually.
We feel that. Well, but why do we feel that? Do we feel like that the German government of the Kaiser was that territorial, that they were out to take over the world? From what we've studied so far. Pardon? I didn't think they had the forces either. I mean, they didn't have them in World War II to do it. I don't think they had it in World War I. I don't think they had the inclination either. I think Germans were in it to steal some colonies from the British and the French, and that ultimately they may have gone after American colonies too. But I don't think there was an immediate danger. They wouldn't have been Democrats. They would not have promoted democracy in Europe, that's for sure. Would there have been the same likelihood of as a Hitler in 25 years?
Possibly.
But is there a case to be made that maybe it would have prevented Hitler? And I'm not a pro-German victory person here, but it's very feasible that the way Hitler came to power was because of the devastation and the defeat and the treatment of Germany after the war. And had they not been treated that way, there may have been no breeding grounds for that to happen. Well, I'm only planting this seed for this reason. When we get into discussing the foreign policy in the 20s and 30s, as Hitler starts to become a noticeable threat, but we don't want to do anything about it, there are lots of people starting to say, if we had stayed out of the first conflict, how would it have been? But that's not how people felt at the time. At the time, people felt like Germany represents an autocratic threat to peace. Democracies need to be buttressed and protected. And the British did their best to try to build upon that through propaganda, through news coverage. We didn't discuss this person, but are you familiar with Cyrus Field as a technological inventor? 1867, did something to advance communications. Yep, created the Atlantic, or put together the Atlantic cable connecting Europe to America, first telegraphically and later telephonically. Field, Cyrus Field. He's not necessary. Yeah, with no S on the end, I think. So we had been in fact, the reason that the Spanish-American War news could go so quickly and so thoroughly through the wire services is because of this transatlantic cable. That's why things back and forth in Europe moved so much quicker than in prior times. Well, the British, at the outset of this war, cut the cable. And since they dominate the oceans, they can send by ship the news accounts they want us to hear. And what are the news accounts they send? The atrocities of the barbaric Germanic Huns, raiding neutral Belgium, looting and pillaging and causing starvation, which was true. So it didn't have to be that big of a propaganda. And in fact, in response to the famine that hit Belgium in the German invasion, an American came forward, offered his services, coordinated farmers and the government together to put together food relief for the Belgians. Who was this person? Who was involved in protecting Christians in his home in the Boxer Uprising in 1900? And future president of the United States. And Quaker. Hoover. Yep. Herbert Hoover came forward and put together the Belgian Food Relief Program. He did such a good job of it that Woodrow Wilson would later, after we're in the war, appoint him to become food administrator, to make sure that as food administrator enough grain was grown to feed our troops, feed our people, feed the Allies. And none of it through hardcore government regulation, but rather cooperative negotiations. Did a fine job of it. So well that, in fact, Hoover in the 1920s would serve for Harding and Coolidge as Secretary of Commerce. And in that capacity, same way. He would work partnerships between businesses and government. And he didn't have to enforce the antitrust laws. He didn't have to get strict about court orders concerning minimum wage standards, because he could get these businesses to pretty much cooperate with voluntary standards. So Hoover, from the time of the Belgian Food Relief Program on through the 20s, was seen as the person who knows how to take care of people and take care of the economic conditions. That's not how he's remembered, though. How do most people remember Hoover?
Pardon?
Hoovervilles, yeah. And what were Hoovervilles? Shanty town shacks of people out of job, out of work, all because, and why is Hoover get named for that? Yep, because he was president when the stock market crash occurred and the depression hit, and at the end of his four-year term, it had worsened and not better. So many people will paint Hoover up as the callous rich person who took care of his rich buddies and let everybody else suffer, and that FDR cleaned it all up. Well, FDR didn't clean it all up. Hoover didn't let everybody suffer, but the images do stick there. And it's kind of strange considering his earlier times in life. But back to the original purpose. I got off on a little rant there. The invasion of Belgium by Germany was, like I said, blown up, but it didn't have to be blown up that badly by the British. All they had to do was just portray it, which reminds me of, again, something that I was talking with somebody earlier about, not on the test, but in World War II, when Frank Capra, film director, was asked by the government to put together propaganda films for us against Germany, he studied the whole situation and came back with an idea. He says, why make new films? Just show theirs. The same propaganda films the German government is showing their own people about Nazi superiority and Jewish vermin and defending Nazi honor. Just show all that to Americans. That's good enough. That'll make them pro-war. So, propaganda during wartime, government sponsored, is a really interesting study area. The British also made much over the use of German submarines. And it was to their advantage to do so, because the Germans had not made the choice to invest a lot of money on an above-sea fleet. They went with the underwater U-boats or submarines. Cheaper, more efficient. But what was the publicity, or public relations nightmare associated with submarine activity compared to battleships above sea? Yeah, it's sneaky. It's murder, it looks like. Because traditional warfare on the ocean rules had it that if you approach a ship, you can't quite tell whether they're civilian or military, you're supposed to give warning. You're supposed to give them the opportunity to surrender, or at least disembark their women and children and civilians before they engage in battle. Submarine gave any kind of warning that they're going to attack, they're vulnerable, and that their element of surprise is gone. So German submarines always worked on surprise attack, and since that wasn't traditional naval warfare, it fell right into the laps of the British propagandists to portray the Germans as being so evil. So that helped shape American public opinion as 1914 turned to 15 to 16, and especially after Americans start dying aboard ships that Germans sink. Another feature that made Americans pro-Allied, and this one becomes quite controversial also later in the 1930s, it is the amount of business taking place with the Allies. Now, it is true that Americans traded, lent money, sold weapons, sold foodstuffs to both sides in this conflict. But in large disproportionate numbers, more was sold to the Allied side because it was easier to get to the British and the French than the German side. When the Germans disrupted our trade to the Allies, it was usually through sinkings, which is death and nobody gets paid. When the British interrupted and brought contraband material into their ports, it may have been against the wishes of the merchant, but nobody died, and usually the confiscated materials were paid for. So people went back home, profited by it, and eventually in time, most of the trade and the loans, etc., just went to the Allied direction. So while we were claiming we were neutrals, we were feeding one side completely against the other by 1915-1916. Yeah, yeah, they did. The English, the trading to the, building the battering rams for the Confederates in the South. And the Union government was in that same tricky spot of how do we try to prevent English involvement without triggering English entry into the war and losing. So. And that's their scenario where Lincoln deserves great praise. And as we've discussed earlier, I think the Emancipation Proclamation was built around that notion. This business of lending money and selling munitions to the Allies will become a very sore spot in the 1920s and 30s when in the 20s the Europeans try to not pay it back. And then in the 30s, people start claiming that we were dragged into war not to make the world safe for democracy, but we were dragged into the war by the so-called merchants of death, the munition makers and bankers who wanted more profit. So that brings us down to, it looks like, 13. May 7th, 1915, the Lusitania, a British luxury liner, has sailed to the United States and is making plans to return. The Germans take out newspaper ads in New York City papers warning Americans, do not sail on the ship. It's going to be loaded with armaments and our submarines are going to sink it. Take out newspaper commercial ads in New York newspapers, the German embassy speaking for the government, warning Americans, those expecting to travel on this luxury liner are headed for death. Don't travel on the ship. But Americans did anyway. It was attacked and sunk. Over 1,000 killed and 128 of them were Americans. Now, with this warning, why did they ride anyway? Well, I think they didn't believe it for... I mean, if someone tells you they're going to fire, don't you take it serious? But you're right, they didn't take it serious. Why not? So that was it. They misinterpreted the idea. If it was that public, if it was something that could be hidden, maybe they might do it. But once it's that publicized, it couldn't help but lead to war, so they wouldn't do it. So Americans believe that they were protected neutrals, that we are not in this fight on either side. Germany doesn't dare take the risk, but they did. And this brought up a big debate among those who were wanting to go to war and those who wanted to stay out of the conflict. Wilson sent a stern message to the German government demanding apology and a pledge and promise that no more ships with Americans aboard would be sunk. Which the Germans replied, okay, we give a pledge. Lusitania pledge, we'll avoid sinking ships with Americans aboard, and we apologize. Now, how out of a periscope, miles away, can you tell whether a ship is even a civilian or military ship, let alone what stick figures happen to be Americans and which are not? So there was no way that the Germans could honor such a promise. And a pledge of no more sinkings. They could sink ships that we're not on, but not the ones we're on. And before we go on to the next page, let's look at how William Jennings Bryan responded to this. What role was William Jennings Bryan playing in the Wilson administration? In fact, why isn't he a fourth time losing presidential candidate? Why isn't there a Republican running this war? Yes, he volunteered to not run that time if he could choose the candidate, which he did, Wilson, and if he could be Secretary of State. So he is now in the position of being the Condoleezza Rice here. He's the one that's supposed to put forward the administration's policies. and he was in complete opposite ends of this. He was furious with Wilson. Bryan had been in favor of the ban and was angry with the switch away from the ban of trade. Now that this has happened, he thought surely that would prove that Wilson had to start preventing Americans from traveling, and it didn't. They're going in opposite directions. And so he very publicly resigns and makes a big scene out of it, to which Wilson and most say, it's about time. In fact, I think one of the comments that Wilson made was, now we can serve something besides grape juice at the state dinners.
What?
We can serve something besides grape juice at the state dinners because of his high religious morals about anti-alcohol use in the White House. Replaced by Robert Lansing. Lansing was very much in favor of the Allied side of the war and shoved Wilson in that direction. So we start to see a move away from neutrality on Wilson's part following these changes in Secretary of State. Well, as we see on the next page in number 14, more sinkings occur. One of them that involved the deaths of Americans was the Arabic, a British ship. And outrage, demands for pledges were made. The Germans complied, apologized, made the Arabic pledge, no more sinking of ships. Then in 1916, it happens with the French ship, the Sussex. Same thing again. So here's the song and dance that Wilson and the Germans go through. Promise not to do it again. We promise. They do it again. And it keeps going on. The 1916 election arrives in number 15. Okay. That's cool. I like it when somebody says something like that. That means we're all together here.
Prohibition was going on during this time.
Getting ready to start. Prohibition is voted into place in 1919 and takes effect in 1920. In fact, prohibition is World War I related. Back to that grain issue. Is there enough grain to make liquor and feed our allies? Mm-hmm. There's not. So, yeah. You mean use good barley just to run our cars? Yeah, that's how we need public transportation. But the other forms that I can see, I think that's reasonable. Brazil's doing that already, aren't they? Pretty successful.
Yeah.
Well. Well, when gasoline reaches the point where it's more expensive than doing that, then that's probably going to be the natural turn of events, isn't it? So. What do we pay a gallon now? $2.50?
Mm-hmm.
What are the Europeans paying? $5, $6, $7, $8?
Yeah, a gallon. California pays over
$3.14. Well, eventually these alternative fuel sources will be cheaper and then it'll be better. Is it wrong of me to speak bad of Caribou? I'd use all that Alaskan oil and use a strategic hamlet program and find somewhere to ship those Caribou to a new village or something. Possible. But not until we've used up all the Mideast oil. Always drink everybody else's liquor first before you turn on your own. But anyway, back to this. Election of 1960. Wilson's running for re-election. He was a Democrat. Who was the last Democrat to win the presidency before him? Cleveland, twice, but not in a row. Prior to Cleveland, who was it? Cleveland doing it in 84 and 92. It takes a thinking back there to get it. It's 1856, Buchanan was the last Democrat. So the point being here is Republicans usually won presidential elections from 1856 up until 1932. The only two exceptions being Cleveland and Wilson. And how did Wilson win the 1912 one? Maybe not. Yeah, two Republicans made it a lot easier, like Lincoln won against two Democrats. So that's not going to be available to him in 1916. So there is great concern about how will he win an election on his own without Republicans shooting themselves in the foot at the same time. Well, one of the things that Wilson does is he changes his progressive reform approach. When he came into office, he was for reducing the size of government, reducing the size of business, getting back to smaller times, laissez-faire times. He saw that was not popular, and so he switched over to a Theodore Roosevelt mode of progressive reform. That is, bigger government, bigger regulations, and bigger taxes, etc. And that gave him a domestic advantage. In foreign policy, though, he comes up with the quote, "He kept us out of war," and many believe he won the election on that quote. Now, what did Woodrow Wilson do that kept us out of war? I saved our savings because I didn't spend it all. You know, that's pretty much it. In other words, his approach—if he'd followed Bryan's suggestions, you could have stayed out of war by not ever letting anybody sail over there anymore. So, what's really keeping us out of war is the patience of the Germans, maybe, and how much you sink and how much you don't. But it was a.
So, do you think there is a conflict between the people? Because Americans were killed on the ship.
Oh, yeah.
And the people were outraged about that. Was it the economic aspect?
That was it. It was the merchant. In that first year of having a ban, New England was so infuriated that they said that he would not win midterm elections or presidential elections. So I hate to always put things down to the idea of winning elections, but you just couldn't win without the Northeast. And so, and maybe he was sympathetic to the economic problems they were suffering, but it is true. He let Americans go into harm's way in order to protect business. And that becomes, again, this argument in the 1930s. To what degree was Woodrow Wilson a tool and puppet of big business, and to what degree was he sincere about entry into the war?
So when
when the vote was count, it wasn't until late the next day that the California popular vote could be counted and figure out, that sounds nothing new to us anymore to have to wait a day or two to figure it out. But there was most elections in the 20th century, you knew that same night, if you remember those days. And so to wait all the way until the next day to find out what California did was pretty surprising. And it seemed like it was going to be close, but it turned out after some other states' counts came in that he had a pretty good margin victory. But there was a lot of worry that without the Republicans splitting up, he was going to lose. He ran against Republican Charles Evans Hughes. We mentioned Hughes just briefly when we talked about progressivism. He was one of those progressive governors like Hiram Johnson and Robert La Follette. At this point in life, Charles Evans Hughes was serving on the Supreme Court as an associate justice. So he left the court and became a Republican presidential candidate. Lost. Was reappointed to the court in the 1920s by Harding. And I'm not exactly sure who did it, but by the 1930s, I guess it was probably Hoover, he was elevated to Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So Hughes would be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the 1930s, battling against FDR's New Deal programs.
Okay, when he was reappointed by
who? Reappointed by Harding in the 20s to be back on the court. And here's a piece of trivia that is of no great significance. He's the last bearded presidential candidate of a major party. Do you remember Perot's second running mate? There was Pat Choate, and that may be who I'm talking about. And then there was the military figure who got a little confused during the debates. Yeah, and he also said, "I don't even know why I'm up here." But that's not who the guy. I'm not mentioning him. I think it was Pat Choate. He had a beard. So that was a vice presidential candidate. Has there been any other bearded presidential candidates? Definitely not of major parties. Oh well, minor significance. He lost. Wilson won. And right after the electoral vote was certain, in December of 1916. Wilson sends a White House advisor, Edward House, Colonel Edward House, on a mission tour of Europe. And the purpose is to speak to the heads of state of every country at war in World War I. With the simple question, what would you settle for and end the war with right now? If you could negotiate an end to this thing, get out of it early, what do you have before you'll negotiate your way out? He was hoping everybody would say after 2 years of fixed trench warfare where nobody had moved and thousands were killed, they'd say, we're ready just to negotiate a break even, a draw. When House returned, he informed Wilson that they all want everything. They all want full victory. They're so angry at the deaths caused by each other that they're unwilling to negotiate a ceasefire. So that pretty well tells it for Wilson that this war is not something that's going to be easy to stay out of, that will probably be dragged in. And in the early months, in March of 1917, that comes to be true for three definite reasons. Item 16, item 17, and item 19. So already, you know the way I write tests. All of the following reasons brought the U.S. into World War I except, pick the imposter. Here's the first one, item 16. On February 1st, 1917, Germany announces that they're no longer going to honor pledges as their promises to protect American lives. They're going to sink anything that sails in European waters. So if you don't want to get killed, don't come around. Now, they know that such a declaration is likely to trigger American entry into war. And it probably did, and it was the mistake that caused them to lose the war. So why did they make that decision? I think the thinking was that, yes, America will enter, but the idea that they could get together forces and troops and materials across that ocean to make a difference, not in time, but if we can cut off all trade and starve off the Allies, victory can be ours before the Americans arrive. And that was their thinking, and it was false and wrong. That was one of the reasons for doing it. So from February through March, submarine activity occurs. No doubt the British news agency is publishing it to great degrees. Americans are dying. While I'm not on it, one to two thoughts just came through my mind. Another action by the British, and that was some of this is fact, some of this is innuendo, some of this deals with Jewish people, so you got to be real careful in the discussion. But the Balfour Declaration, are we familiar with that? I can't remember the first name of the... He was a foreign secretary for Britain. I'm thinking David Balfour, but that may be a character from Treasure Island. Somebody Balfour was the foreign minister for the British government. And this famous 1917 declaration comes out. Anybody have any recollection as to what it's related to? It has relevance to current day situations, for sure. Well, Balfour declares that the area of Palestine will be turned into a homeland for Jewish people. Now, this is the long-sought dream of Zionists since the movement has restarted in the early 1800s in Eastern Europe. And it's the British who make the first concrete effort. You definitely don't have to write all this down. I mean, if you want to, that's cool. It's not going to be on a test. That Palestine shall be considered a homeland for the Jewish diaspora around the world to come back to. Now, Balfour himself is not a super religious or pro-Jewish person. There's other reasons involved here. And to bring this into light, let's also say this. If you heard of T.E. Lawrence, played by Peter O'Toole in the movie back in the 50s, Lawrence of Arabia? He was a British military officer who organized Arab resistance against the Turks, doing so in Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. So what's happening here is the British are trying to get the Arabs to revolt against the Turkish Empire so it'll weaken the Turks, making World War I more able to be victorious, but also making it possible that the Turkish Empire will fall apart and the British can gobble up oil regions, which does happen. At the same time, they're making these agreements with Arab factions to overthrow the Turks. They're promising Jewish people in England, but also in America. And it is said that the New York Times, owned by the Sulzberger family, was of Jewish background, was also deeply involved in promoting this Zionist dream. The historic theory being put forward before it, is that Jewish people in England and Jewish people in America would contribute a lot more of their support and money to the war effort if a homeland in Palestine could be guaranteed. So the Balfour Declaration makes this promise that there will be a Jewish homeland in Palestine following the war, while at the same time promising Palestinian Arabs you will have an independent state free from Turkey following the war. So this falls into this British propaganda use. Is there a connection between the New York Times and the London Times and the news agencies so that it's not just British propaganda portraying submarine warfare? At this point, the New York Times and other newspapers are also in the fray publishing submarine activity. Now, there's not hard evidence to all this, but this is one of the suspicions of history. But regardless of whether New York or British newspapers are portraying this, the Germans are doing the sinking, so they're the ones making their own bad publicity here. In March of 1917, 1 month after the first announcement, the British Naval Intelligence releases to the Associated Press a captured German telegram called the Zimmermann Telegram. Alfred Zimmermann being the foreign minister for Germany. German telegram to Mexico, released March 1st, 1 month after the submarine announcement. Truth be known, the British naval intelligence had captured this telegram and had deciphered the announcement back in January and figured the best thing to do is let them make the announcement, kill some Americans for a month, then, when the time is right, release the Zimmermann telegram's existence. Here's what the telegram said. It was an invitation to Mexico to join the war against the United States. Early 1917. Didn't we discuss that back in 1916 a boatload of guns had come in for Huerta from Germany? So the guns and now the telegram, there's a lot of stuff going on here. And if Mexico is interested in joining this war against the United States, Germany will do its best to help them get back Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. Didn't mention California.
Well, what's Japan?
It's coming up.
Okay.
Gets even zanier here. I often wonder if the Germans wanted Hollywood for themselves or something, so they're going to win this thing. If Mexico was interested in this offer, then they were expected to go to Japan and ask Japan to switch sides, and the promise will be they can have the Hawaiian Islands. So quit stealing our German and Chinese islands and we'll let you have the Hawaiian Islands.
If they were interested,
if the Mexicans were interested in this offer, not only do they get back Texas and Arizona and New Mexico, but they're expected to go to Japan, negotiate for the Germans to switch sides, like Italy kind of switched sides. I mean, it didn't really switch sides, it just joined the other side.
So
with Japan to switch sides, and Japan's reward would be they get to have the Hawaiian Islands. Which would imply a Japanese invasion of the Hawaiian Islands and maybe some German assistance, and so maybe some kind of an early version of Pearl Harbor happening. What do you think the Mexican government's response was? Not at all. In fact, they received the telegram well before it was publicized and already had not responded, not rejected. They wanted and didn't want this in the news, that those Americans all wired up, you know. And of course it goes into the news.
So Mexico just pretended they didn't get it.
Yeah, they just no response. But for Americans watching the sinkings, the policy, the Zimmermann telegram, it's ratcheting up the anti-German feeling. And then a third event in number 19 occurs, the first of two Russian revolutions. We're going to discuss both. When Russia entered the war, they didn't have anywhere near the industrial output power as the rest of these nations that did, these major nations. They lost almost every battle on the Eastern campaign. They were so underarmed that it was said they would tell troops in the rear, we know you don't have guns, but when your comrades up front get killed, pick their guns up and keep going. It's not very much of a morale builder. And so as the war got worse for the Russians, most of the food rations were supposedly sent to the soldiers. Soldiers complained they never saw them. There weren't any available for civilians in Russia. So military defeat one after another and eventual starvation caused a lot of people in Russia to get sick and tired of this war and wanted the Tsar to get out of it. In February or March, we'll explain why both come up, a food riot broke out in St. Petersburg, or Petrograd as it was called at the time. What happened was women who went down to the stores to pick up grain were told there were none. Knowing they'd be beat by their husbands when they got home, they said, "We know where there's grain," and they broke in and started stealing the grain from the storage bins. And when police were called out to stop them, it did mushroom from there into a full-scale revolt, and the Tsar figured it out that he's going to get blamed for all this, so he just ran off and quit. The reason that you sometimes hear this is called as the February Revolution or the March Revolution is later, when the Bolsheviks take over Russia, they will change the calendar of Russia from the old Julian up to the modern-day Gregorian calendar, and 11 days are readjusted. So what was February in Russia was already March in other parts of the Western world. Same is true for the October-November Revolution, two names. So the Tsar abdicates, Nicholas II abdicates the Russian throne. Russia then falls under a temporary government, a provisional government, led by the Russian legislature, the Duma, D-U-M-A. It's not on our sheet, but so go back over what happened was, when this food riot results in the abdication of Nicholas II, the legislature of Russia, D-U-M-A, the Duma, assumes authority in his absence. Now, this part you don't have to write down, but just kind of put something together. We talked about Russia being a non-democratic country. What's with this legislature? Well, when Russia lost the fleet in 1905 against Japan and then came out of the negotiations pretty bad off, it was so embarrassing to the Tsar that a revolt, a protest riot broke out then called Bloody Sunday in 1905. And one of the ways of quelling angry Russians was to create this legislature, the Duma. So this thing had been in existence since 1905. It really didn't speak with any authority. It was a puppet hanger-on of the Tsar. But now that the Tsar is gone, it's got to really rule. And they make proclamations that they will take Russia into the modern age of democracy. So now why am I including this revolt as a cause for American entry? It really would seemingly have nothing to do with us. Woodrow Wilson sees it as the opportunity. Now all three major powers, Britain, France, and Russia, are democracies or struggling to be democracies, and all three major enemy powers, Germany, Austria, and Turkey, are autocracies. This is a true fight for the existence of freedom and justice and democracy versus that which is not. We've got to make sure this Russian Revolution succeeds by winning this war. And that's why Wilson goes to Congress in the first week of April of 1917, what, 80, 90 years ago, this exact week, and asks for a war declaration.
Well, going back to 18 now.
Okay. 18 probably would have been, if I had made that before 17 and said as February turns to March, that would have made the story sound better, wouldn't it? But the sinkings further aggravate, but there's more sinkings in March even after the telegrams. The February and March sinkings further aggravate public opinion.
But they were, the Germans doing the sinking?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Let's say something else about, oh, before we go into 21, which I'm going to do here in a second. Yeah, we're going to talk about him in just a moment here. And my mistake I always make is I get into Wilson, I get all excited about Wilson. Before you know it, I've forgotten about the Second Revolution. I'll try not to do that. But, what did Britain and France, the two democracies that he's praising, did they get into World War One? From our study, did they get into World War One to make the world safer democracy? No. Oh. You hear these claims all the time that democracies don't start wars. Autocracies do. Clinton was strong about making those claims. When there was a problem with Haiti, he talked about Haiti being one of the few non-remaining, along with Cuba, non-democracies, and if you could make every country in the Central America democracies, war would go away. That's a traditional view, but it's not really true for World War One. Britain and France got into this thing for the same reason the Germans and Austrians did: steal land, alliances, nationalism. So, for a PhD in history, is Wilson kind of out to lunch or in La La Land, thinking that this can now be a clear-cut democracy versus autocracy battle? No, he's... what's he thinking, maybe? That's the critics in the 1930s. The foolish Wilson, tool of the industrialist, tool of the merchants of death, off in a dreamy world being led down the path by Wall Street brokers. I don't believe that. My opinion of this is, Wilson's a shrewd enough politician to know he's not dealing with humanitarian allies, but what he's thinking is American involvement will so turn the tide of the war that the victory will be because of us, and they'll be obligated to listen to our peace treaty. And in our peace treaty we negotiate, we'll make it so that everything's fair and just, and there'll be no more wars. That's his 14 points. That's where I think he's going with this. Interesting thought. It didn't turn out that way, but that's what he has in mind, is I can dictate the peace. And when he gets to Paris and is welcomed with parades of screaming Parisians, he really believes it's possible. He goes to Congress and he doesn't say, here in item 21, he doesn't say that we need to go to war because submarines are insulting us and taking our profits away, killing our people. He doesn't mention submarines to Congress. He just says, we've got to make the world safe for democracy. We've got to fight the war to end all wars. This belief that if America brings the victory, we can restructure the world. That these old world Europeans, all they know is killing and fighting and lack of human rights, we Americans will come to the rescue, save the world. It's not the only time we think like that, is it? When I first taught for many years, I was sarcastic and would say, fighting a war to end all wars is like going to bed to protect somebody's virginity. I stopped that in 1991. Why? With who? Iraq over Kuwait, the invasion of Kuwait. And for the first time I saw, finally, what the League of Nations could never do, the United Nations can start doing. If the United Nations can discipline a nation not to invade a neighbor... And it's different than the Korea situation because that's Cold War related. If you can get nations fearful that they can't invade their neighbors because all the United Nations will come to their aid, that'll end war. It'll be Wilson's dream, the war that ends all wars. And here I've been making fun of it all the time. I really went through a lot of soul searching and quit saying it. Did that war end all wars in the Middle East?
Obviously not.
No, obviously not. But boy, it felt like it in 1991, though. Had a tinge of that Wilsonian feeling. You're saying if we'd gotten stuck back then, we wouldn't be stuck now? Is that the theory? If we'd gone in, taken Baghdad, and gotten stuck back then, we wouldn't be stuck now? You know, even Clinton and Gore took cheap shots in that regard. Yeah, well, we got 17 nations on board because we were only freeing Kuwait, not taking over Baghdad. But it's appealing and it's luring for historians to think, just let me be president, let me run the outcome of things, and we'll fix this world. And that's where Wilson was going with this. Well, a second revolution does take place, and it's important to our story, so let's go back up and look at 20. The Duma conducting the Russian government from March on until October, or March until November, doesn't do the two things people want, peace and food. They don't feed the people, they don't get out of the war. And so enthusiasm wanes quickly for this government. Various factions of revolutionary scheme for their chance. The most viable revolutionary force was the Social Democratic Party of Russia. This I'm going to get into a little bit more than what's on the sheet here. The Social Democratic Party of Russia split in 1903 into two halves, Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. Bolshevik word is in number 20.
What, in what year?
1903, back when they started. Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. The majority of the people sided with the Mensheviks. A smaller number went with the Bolsheviks. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, Lenin. Lenin is kind of like a Superman name for Clark Kent or something. That wasn't his real name. Lenin adopted the name Bolshevik for his faction because in Russian it means majority. So he took the minority wing and adopted the majority title and dubbed the Mensheviks the word minority. Leon Trotsky was the leader of the Mensheviks and Lenin was head of the Bolsheviks. Yeah, T-R-O-T-S-K-Y. And from 1903 up until this revolution, those two halves debated how a communist revolution should take place. They're both Marxists. The Trotsky view is communist revolutions cannot succeed until a well-entrenched industrial working class is ready to overthrow the owners. And Russia is not industrial. It's all peasant farming, so it's nowhere near ready. And the Lenin viewpoint is, if we wait for Russia to get ready, I won't get to be in charge. So we need to kind of readjust Marxian history and telescope history down to the point where we'll overthrow the government, set up a communist government, and then build the industrial working class. Back in 1905, when that Duma was created, so were their underground councils created called Soviets. So these are like unofficial legislatures that the common working class people meet in total violation of Russian law.
So they were a secret society.
Secret council, secret gatherings. Well, after this first revolution in 1917, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks both start moving to try to gain control over these Soviet councils that were in Petrograd and Leningrad and elsewhere, Moscow and elsewhere. And in the summer of 1917, Lenin and Trotsky make up. They say, let's combine our forces and quit competing with each other and lead a Soviet revolution. Let's take these councils and overthrow the Russian government. Lenin says, I'll be the top dog, you'll be the second. Trotsky agrees. Even though he had more members than the Mensheviks, they weren't as committed as the Bolshevik faction. So that's why in the fall, in October and November, the second revolution can be launched. The Germans help. And here is how. This is the fall of the Duma, I guess, the provisional government. Many of these people we're speaking of conduct these ideas and these negotiations outside of Russia because they're in exile. Lenin was in exile this time. Lenin spoke secretly with the German government, said, if you will help me sneak back into Russia, I can foment a Soviet uprising, take over Russia, and pull it out of the war. And you can move all your Eastern Front troops to the West and win before the Americans get in. So the German government places him in a sealed train car. It's often been believed he was in the sealed car to protect his entry. He was in the sealed car so he couldn't propagandize at every train stop in Germany when he came to it. Goes through Finland, makes it back into Russia, leads the Soviet uprising, both in Moscow and in Petrograd. And that's the Communist Revolution, the Soviet Revolution of Russia. And as promised, he sends Trotsky to negotiate with the Germans in January of 1918 in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in Item 20. So the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk officially sees Russia withdraw from World War I. Now the Allies really have something to worry about. Can the restationed German troops make a difference? Turns out they didn't make a difference because the Germans didn't trust the Russians and left most of their troops and forces in the east. Well, the purpose of this treaty, the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, is so it stops the war between the Germans and the Russians. That allows the Russians to rebuild their country outside of war and allows the Germans to move their troops to the west. Now, last thing before we go, and I'm sorry I'm keeping you so long, but the last thing I want to mention here is in 1918, after all this happens, Allied powers, Japan, Italy, France, Britain, United States also, put together a force of soldiers and invade Russia in an effort to put the Tsar back in power so that they can come back into the war, open back up that Eastern Front. So here are all these Allied powers trying to overthrow the Bolsheviks, put the Tsar back in power. What year does the war end? That year, 1918. So why are they still in Russia as far as 1921? Cool. Animals gone, barn doors open, it's too late now. Why do these Allied forces continue to fight a civil war against the Bolsheviks, or help with a civil war, after there's no reason to get back into the war? Yes, to prevent a first communist government from succeeding, because who knows how many will follow. These are capitalist nations that don't want to see a communist revolution spread across the world. Years later, after World War II, during the Cold War, when we talk about the fear of Soviet invasions, they say, who's invaded whom? We never invaded America. You invaded us and tried to overthrow our government, which was true. So we'll be on more of 21 when we return.